Berkshire Theatre Group presents Emmy Award winner Lee Kalsheim's world premiere, Coming Back Like a Song, on the Fitzpatrick Main Stage in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, June 28th through July 21st.
Yep, it's the play in 1956, and three of America's great songwriters, Irving Berlin, Howard Laughlin, and Jimmy Van Heusen, are at crossroads in their lives. Rock and roll is now king, and their careers could be over.
Directed by Tony Award nominee Greg Edelman, Coming Back Like a Song features Tony Award nominee David Garrison as Irving Berlin, Philip Hoffman as Harold Arlen, and David Rashi as Jimmy Van Heusen.
We're joined now by the playwright Lee Kalsheim, director Greg Edelman, and actor David Garrison.
Welcome all.
Hey, good morning.
Thank you very much.
All right, so let us begin with you, Greg, as to what this is all about and how you came to a world premiere and bringing this to life.
Oh, well, Kate McGuire has been kind enough to employ me for 4 years now here. And I think it's November or so, I got an email or a phone call from her, and she said, you know, we did a reading of this new play, and it was great, and the audience loved it, and I think I want to do it next year. And it was this play. And I read it, and I thought, oh, this is really cool, and I like it, and the fact that it had such a successful reading. I said, sure, sign me up. And that's when I met Lee Kalsheim, sitting across the table here, and we started the journey, you know. And it's one of those shows that's it's very special. It's unique. You know, you're always looking for something a little special, you know, a little different. And at the same time, perhaps maybe it sort of rings a bell. It's you know, it just means something, and it has a little sort of tug to the heart, tug to the, you know, the mind. And sure. And that's what this piece does. It's lovely.
Lee, where did your journey with this begin?
Well, I was listening to Jonathan Swartz's show in New York that he plays old Broadway music and stuff. And I think John Lahr was on, and they talked about the fact that after the ASCAP meetings in New York, Jimmy Van Heusen, Irving Berlin, Harold Arlen would go over to Berlin's apartment and talk and drink and sing and blah, blah, blah. That's all I heard. So as a playwright, it stuck in the back of my mind. And I thought, what if it were 1956? And this was going on. And I said, rock and roll is king. They must have been scared out of their minds. And that was the motivation. That's the start of the play. They said, you know, we're finished. Our careers are over. And Berlin had a history of always being a little behind the ball. You know, in 1927, Oscar Hammerstein, they wrote, Showboat came out, a different kind of musical. And he said, well, I can do that. And every time he caught up and he kept renewing his career. But this, he's now in his 60s. And he's wondering, can I do this? Arlen, and it's part of the play, Arlen was in the toilet psychologically. Anyhow, his wife was in a sanitarium. Beautiful woman. And he treasured her, and he kind of lost her. And a lot of the play is about these guys getting together, particularly Van Heusen and Berlin, and getting him out of that, you know, and getting him back into life. And the play is about getting back into the life. You get knocked down. We all get knocked down in this business. It's hard. And you get back up. And Van Heusen, ironically, he was part of Sinatra's Rat Pack. He wrote some of Sinatra's best songs, so his career took off. But he didn't know it at the time. And so we're at that moment. And that's what I always think when I'm writing a play. I always think, why is this night different from all other nights? And you can't write a play unless that's the code. That's in the back of your mind. I don't want a typical day in somebody's life. I want the most unusual day.
So what kind of research do you do to get that, where they were in their lives?
Well, that was the next step. I said, well, this is a great idea for a play. And I read all the books I could on them. And I got lucky and found out that they were quite different gentlemen, quite different. And that so that, therefore, the combination of the three of them in a room was going to be interesting. And so I read all the material on them, the various memoirs and biographies. And then I went to Ted Chapin, who handles Berlin's publishing company, Imagine. I said, Ted, I'd like to do a play about them. Here's what the idea is. And he said, you'll have to write it because I have to show it to his daughters. His daughters were in their 80s now. They're in their 90s. I said, So I wrote it. And I gave it to him. He gave it to the daughters. And they said, fine. And then I was off. Then, you know, and I said, okay.
Was he a nice man?
He's terrific. Yeah.
He was.
He is. He still is.
Irving Berlin's still
Oh,
alive?
Irving Berlin.
Yeah.
No. I thought you meant that.
No, the question is about Irving Berlin.
Irving Berlin, yes. I had tea with his daughter about 2 weeks ago because she sent me notes. I get this email from Mary Ellen Barrett, who's, oh, that's his daughter. And she gave me a list of notes. And the funny thing about them is that he, for instance, there's a scene in the play where Harold Arlen is making a phone call to his wife in a sanatorium, and he sees a Matisse, in the original script, a Matisse painting in the bedroom where he's making the call, and he comes out and he says, Irving, is that a real Matisse? He said, yeah, I got it on my honeymoon, blah, blah, blah. So I get a note from, and then Berlin ends up giving it to Arlen as a gesture, you know, because you like it so much, I don't even see it anymore. I get a note from Berlin's daughter, he didn't have a Matisse. He had a Chagall lithograph.
A little different.
So I wrote back and I said, a Chagall lithograph is not worth that much money. And the point is, and I changed it to a Chagall silkscreen, but the point is that the idea that he gave him a painting was completely made up by me. That didn't bother her.
Yeah, yeah.
What bothered her was just a little detail. Yeah.
Okay, so I have a question for you as a playwright with integrity. When you are told, if it passes musters with the daughters, you can go ahead. Does it affect the way you write the play?
Not at all. I mean, I did all my research, and a lot of this stuff really happened because from the research. I mean, you know, and I can't tell you. There's a monologue Jimmy Van Heusen has at the end about a woman he meets. I mean, it's sensational. But that was in the memoir. It was in the stories. I added to it. I added things to it. And I made up a lot of stuff, like this giving in the painting, like a lot of the stuff that goes. It was all made up. But it's consistent with what could have happened. And I don't worry about whether it did or that's dramatic license. And if you get called on it by his daughter because you have respect for the father and respect for the family, you say, well, I'll do what I can here. I wouldn't have taken out, if she said, you got to take out that, he never gave him a painting. And then I would have had a literary discussion with her saying, you know, there is such a thing as dramatic license. And it puts a good light on Irving Berlin because he's so generous.
So, David, what is it like, David Garrison playing Irving Berlin?
I think besides being a heavy cross to bear, I think it was Jerome Kern who said Irving Berlin has no place in American music. He is American music, so sure, go on stage and do that.
Keep that in mind.
Really, yeah. But what a fascinating guy. I mean, he's sort of, in his own way, a story of America. I mean, being an immigrant kid and you know, coming from great poverty in the Lower East Side, and then becoming this icon of Americana. I mean, when you think of the stuff he wrote, it's extraordinary. There's all the sort of anthemic songs of every major event in the 20th century, every holiday. I mean, you know, and God Bless America, which is arguably a more patriotic song than the Star Spangled Banner.
Certainly easier to sing.
Well, yeah. And yet he was sort of musically illiterate. I mean, he couldn't read or write music notation. He had a piano that shifted keys because he only played on the black keys in F sharp major. So he had a keyboard that shifted so he could play another other scales. He didn't have the sophistication of Jerome Kern. He didn't have the musicality of Gershwin. He didn't have the wit of Cole Porter. He didn't have the worldliness of Rodgers and Hart, or the sentimentality of Rodgers and Hammerstein. And yet he eclipsed them all. He was the mother lode of American song.
He was a Jew who wrote White Christmas and Easter Parade.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
that's right.
It's remarkable. And he was really a driven guy, and he was a prickly guy. I mean, he was famously hard on employees and hard on others.
That's why I asked him the question. Yeah. Because his reputation was not as the nicest guy who ever walked.
He had this ability to portray sentiment in music, but not so much in life. I mean, apparently he was very close with his wife and family. Not so good with the outside world.
Yep.
The challenge in directing this and bringing it all together among these huge talents, both on your stage but also in history and in life, what is that like?
Well, you know,
how do you get it right? What is the challenge of that?
Well, as with anything, I think as an actor and also as a director, you really do start with the script. And when you have a script that is written with wit and humor and subtlety, thank God, you know, you really have it's like, well, you know, sometimes you're not given that gift that you really have. You're starting off pretty nicely. A show like this, though, and this is something Lee and I have been talking about with the actors who have done so much. It's really impressive. You and I, Lee, we've talked about this when the actors were saying all the research they've done. We were like, wow, these actors are really, you know, putting in the homework before they show up in rehearsal, and that's a real blessing to us. So we've been very fortunate to have that. But the idea when you have something that you include a lot of wonderful historical anecdotes, there is some dramatic license, but you need to make sure with these kind of shows where you have real people, and part of the cool aspect of this kind of theater piece is that they do tell some, you're a bit of a fly on the wall, and you too get to hear great anecdotes about, well, I met this or this happened to Jerome Kern. And so you don't want it too spelled out. You want it, it's like you're sitting in on somebody else's Thanksgiving dinner and you're listening to great stories and you're following along. So, but we've got a great script to start from. I think after that, I think you really do need to let the actors, you cast well, you cast, you know, talented people, but then you don't want to get hooked into like, well, I need an imitation or something. You know, that's the danger. You don't want to do that.
Did you see the Elvis thing last year that Kate did so wonderfully about $1 Million Quartet?
Oh, yes.
That came here, and, yes. You know, I'm wondering whether this follows that kind of an idea.
Not at all.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was the playwright.
This is confusing. This is not what they call a jukebox musical. Right. It's not a musical. It's a play. I wrote it as a play in which three great composers get to sing their songs. And that's what was hard about it, because I didn't want to...
What do you mean sing their songs?
They sing the songs. Their songs.
But it's not a musical.
No. It's a play with a lot of music in it.
Yeah.
And the point is that I didn't want to make it a play in which it seemed like, and then I wrote, and the other guy said, well, I wrote this, and I wrote that. Those, the times when they sing has to be integrated. It has to come from some emotional moment or competitive moment. When I first met with Greg, he says, well, I've been to a lot of parties where there are guys and composers, and they dying to play their stuff. So the fact that they play it, it should not be stand out. They want to do that. But I didn't want it to be, and then I wrote. It has to be.
Yes, it's part of behavior for us as characters. It's not show and tell.
Did you look at him at all on film? I mean, I've seen Irving Berlin in movies.
Yeah, yeah. He is accessible in terms of finding that stuff. Jimmy Van Heusen, not so much. Harold Arlen, yes. But I mean, and Berlin was really, from what I understand, he was very, very protective of his public image.
Absolutely right.
And he was a skillful showman in that he was marketing Irving Berlin as a commodity, and his stuff. And he retained the rights for all his publishing stuff.
Do you think you look a little like him?
No. And that's the thing. But when I have the glass, I'm training my hair even as we speak. For several days now, I've been training my hair back to try, and I will be putting shoe polish in it. And when I have the glasses, I'm relying on the glasses to be the entire character.
I'll do everything.
Think that'll do it.
That'll kill it right there. Yeah. All right, we are out of time, and we have to finish our show because you have to get ready to do your show, continue working on it. We're in your space right now.
I am the director. I could cancel rehearsal. We could go have brunch or something.
Okay, well, I like that idea, too.
Yeah.
But
okay.
You open June 28th. It runs through July 21st. It is the world premiere of Coming Back Like a Song, running on the Fitzpatrick Main Stage in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. I don't want to tell you anything, no spoilers, but there is a piano on stage. I will tell you that. That's, I think it's safe to say there's a piano on stage.
And we will play it.
BerkshireTheaterGroup.org for showtime and ticket information. Gentlemen, a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.